Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
The second week of the prosecution's case in the Derek Chauvin versus State of Minnesota trial continues. On days 8 and 9, the testimony transitions from law enforcement to forensics and concludes with several medical experts. On this episode, we summarize each day's testimony and devote some extra time to discuss the mechanics of breathing. We once again complain about excited delirium because witnesses keep talking about it.
So day 8, the biggest issue is that science can be inconvenient. So, you know, there's things like George Floyd had drugs in his system, and that has to be acknowledged. The prosecution's bringing in a bunch of witnesses to essentially preempt the defense to make it harder for them to bring up some lies or push certain tropes or stereotypes. Really, day 8 is just throwing a bunch of people out there, and it's kind of a shitty day.
A lot of the commentators thought the prosecution did poorly on this day, and it's because they introduced some inconvenient facts. So yeah, this is probably Al Gore's favorite day.
And again, the idea that it's prosecution's worst day is kind of a weird statement, because it's kind of like a punt knowing you get the ball back right in the fourth quarter. I hate fucking sports punts, but it basically is what it is. You're going to give up a little bit because you know you're going to make it up later on. And this is exactly what this is. They know what the defense is going to try to do, and this is what this day is all about.
So the day starts off with the continuation of Jody Steiger, who is a use of force expert employed by the LAPD. His testimony, for the most part, wasn't that interesting, but he lays the groundwork and first introduces this concept of objectively reasonable, which is the standard defined in a Supreme Court doctrine of Graham versus Connor. This comes up numerous times in subsequent witnesses. So I think his intent here is to provide a baseline introduction to the jury, because he's not the first use of force expert we'll see. His general opinion on this, because he is a prosecution witness, it kind of necessarily follows that he believes that this was not an acceptable use of force and that Chauvin overstepped his training and his bounds, and he states that. The defense attempts to argue that there's some reasonableness standard and that reasonable minds can differ. The defense went to the same standard tropes of, you're not an officer, what do you know? Have you ever arrested anybody? You don't know what you're talking about. You just sit in the armchair.
Have you ever been scared before in your life? When's the last time you pulled out your gun and screamed taser? When's the last time you did that?
Yeah, you're not qualified to be a cop in Brooklyn Center.
God, what a fucking mess.
The continuation of this testimony, one of the memorable instances was the defense played a video, and it was a very leading question in which George Floyd mumbles, and it's generally inaudible. You have to really pay attention to determine what was said. And the defense asks, did George Floyd say, I ate too many drugs? And the witness goes, I don't know, I can't make it out. Oh, well, let's listen again. And he listens to it again. And the witness just goes, nah, I don't know what he says. So he just draws the line of like, I don't know what bullshit you're trying to push here. And this comes back later, so remember it. Another key part was on redirect by the prosecution. They discussed positional asphyxia. And this is a key word again that comes up. And it's the concept of when you're on the ground in a prone position, handcuffed behind your back, there are issues with breathing. This is an introduction to, it's not necessarily about the knee on your neck. It's about the pressure applied to you while you're in this position, the witness agreed. There was then a brief discussion about this witness's concept of awful but lawful. There are lawful acts that appear terrible. And the defense was trying to say, well, this was a lawful act, which Chauvin did, but it's awful. And the witness was kind of like,
All these things look awful because they are awful, because at the end of the day, the police job is to get you to react. And they may pop your shoulder out of place, but that's what they say. It's legal, right? Lawful but awful. They're willing to headbutt you to make you listen because you failed to listen. And all the bootlickers are going to say, just listen to the cops. You won't get murdered.
The next witness was a BCA detective. And the BCA is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is the statewide police force in Minnesota. An individual by the name of James Ryerson. He was a lead investigator in this matter. And his background consists of working as a law enforcement officer and then working in white-collar crime investigation, which is awesome. By all accounts, this individual is competent, and he spent much of his testimony discussing the chain of custody of various evidence after the scene was relinquished to the BCA. This is important for the next set of witnesses, but cars were towed, vehicles were stored, they were in a secure location, there's special tape where you write your name on it so that you can observe if the locks are opened or closed, He did everything by the book, it appears. Another piece of his testimony was that during the direct examination, the state intended to show the I Ate Too Many Drugs video, but their technology didn't work, so they proceeded with their direct, and then after recess, they recalled the witness and provided more context to the video.
To put context in the short video that was shown as Exhibit 107, Agent Ryerson, while we were on a break, did you have an opportunity to review Exhibit 127, which is the composite with King's body-worn camera, correct?
Yes.
During that same time period?
Yes.
And prior to the short clip of Lane's body camera that you were shown as Exhibit 1007, is there a discussion about drug use by the officers and attempting to speak to Mr. Floyd?
Yes.
And hearing that section of the audio, did that help you to understand what Mr. Floyd might have been saying that you were asked about by counsel?
Yes.
And, Your Honor, then we would ask to play 127, Exhibit 127, which is queued up to 2020-30 through 2020-101, where that phrase appears that Mr. Ryerson, Agent Ryerson, was asked about.
Please,
Becky, please. Get up on the sidewalk, please, one side or the other, please.
My face getting up bad.
Okay, should we get his legs up?
Hold on, sir.
Just leave him.
All right. Yeah,
the
park's still sitting on there. Please.
So the record should reflect that we've played through 2021-10 with the quote that you were asked about appearing really at 2021-01, correct?
Yes.
Having heard it in context, are you able to tell what Mr. Floyd is saying there?
Yes, I believe Mr. Floyd was saying, I ain't do no drugs.
So it's a little different than what you were asked about when you only saw a portion of the video, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then when you pay attention with context, it becomes much more evident that he said something to the effect of, I ain't do any drugs, which sounds very similar to, I ate too many drugs. This witness basically dispelled what the defense talking point was. You don't hear about this anymore. So the defense tried this stupid gotcha, context-specific manipulation thing, and they got called on it. Upon further examination, the prosecution did a good job of saying, yeah, no, that's not what happened here. And this issue just kind of floated away.
So we talked about the use of force trope, or this idea that cops are always in danger and what they're doing is always correct. That's one of the arguments, okay? It's always there. And then you have this other trope that comes in, which is the drugs make you crazy, right? Drugs make you crazy. Now, we're not even going to talk about drugs make you crazy and you're a scary tall black guy, because that comes later. But, you know, the defense is trying to do everything they can to say, well, I'm in the line of duty. What would you do if there's a crowd chanting you're an asshole because you're killing somebody? Or, you know, this guy's on drugs. We don't know what he's going to do. Or he's a big black scary guy. Or there's a bunch of it that they try to do. They fall back on all the tropes. Interesting throughout, again, the next 3-4 days we talk about here, how many times the defense circles back the same thing. And it's almost nauseating that the defense has this lack of respect for the jurors and actually the context of which this is happening.
So the prosecution just established that George Floyd said, I ain't do any drugs. The prosecution then calls another witness who effectively established that, well, there were drugs in the car. So this is a BCA forensic analyst named Kenzie Anderson. And her entire testimony is about the lineage of finding 3 or 4 white pills in George Floyd's car and the chain of custody and the analysis and where these pills were and how we went through it. This testimony got kind of long for no reason. And the reason is because they initially impounded the car. They took some pictures, did some research. By all accounts, they did everything correct. There was a lot of discussion about, oh, well, why didn't you find the drugs sooner? And it's like, well, because we didn't have context to look for anything. But we left the car exactly as it was after we took pictures, so it's all there if you need to. And the defense later went back and, oh, we need to search the cop car, and they found an additional, like, half pill and some pill residue on the seat or something that had to be analyzed, so they did that. So her entire testimony was just about the chain of custody and the analysis of these various pills. Pretty disinteresting, but it's very procedural.
Yeah, very procedural. This is all chain of custody. Again, this is all setting up for stopping the defense from saying things like tampered or you didn't do a thorough investigation, blah, 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 blah.
There was no cross-examination for McKenzie. The next witness was Brianna Gills. She is also a BCA forensics, and she basically analyzed the contents of the pills. And she talks about the markings on the pills. They appear to be marked with some pharmaceutical RP and then 10-325 on the back, which is the marker for oxycodone and acetaminophen. But upon analysis, it was determined that they contained meth and fentanyl, so these were very likely street pills. She performed analysis on the various pills that were found in the car and determined that there's meth and fentanyl. Generally pretty disinteresting, but the factual outcome is that the pills had meth and fentanyl. And she talks about how her tests are, does it have meth or does it not have meth? Does it have fentanyl or does it not have fentanyl? It's not a quantity, it's a presence, and the various standards for how you measure these things. Again, her testimony is fairly sterile.
It's no different than you buying one of those take-home drug tests for your kids or somebody where you piss in a cup, you dip the thing in there and it changes colors, right? Because at this point in time, this person doesn't know what's in these pills, so they probably have to run them over 55 or 1,000 different assays. But they probably are like, 100 that are common or whatever the number is. They have to know what they're trying to test for because there's an infinite number of chemicals in the universe. So you have to say, I'm looking for opioids or I'm looking for street drugs, right? So they have to go through and they do street drugs. And then what they do is if they find an opioid, then they have to probably go through and find out what type of opioid it is.
That's exactly right.
My guess is.
Yep. And that was the extent of her testimony. From a certain point of view, it was interesting to know how the BCA forensics people do this, but it didn't really add that much to the trial, I guess. It provided information these pills did, in fact, have drugs in it. The next and final witness of the day is an individual named Susan Neath that works for a lab called NMS Labs that did a more detailed analysis of these drugs. And her testimony basically concluded that the pills contain less than 1% of fentanyl and between 1.9% and 2.9% meth. And this is sort of in line with what you would see for street drugs. Street fentanyl is typically less than 1%, but meth is typically in the 90 to 100% threshold. There was no cross-examination. The end of the day is that the prosecution established that these drugs had meth and fentanyl. Pretty disinteresting, but the defense was going to raise it.
Day 9. I gotta go to the top. We actually are organized a little bit. The theme of this one is, you shouldn't fuck with people that understand science, especially if you bring in, an expert who is, the expert on any topic. Not, someone who read the internet and pretends that can answer questions. I mean, you bring in, the expert. And what I'm leading to here is that they bring in, the expert on pulmonology. You should watch this testimony. Go to day 9. Go to, hour 2 or something?
So he starts the day, and it's roughly 6 hours.
It is so great.
Hour 2, right after the first break, is where the good shit happens.
I mean, it sucks that we're doing this because someone died. If you want to see an expert witness come in and dunk on somebody, watch this testimony. There's one point where this guy, and we're not even telling what the context of it is, looks over at the defense after he just fucking slams him into the ground.
He's a pulmonologist. He works at the University of Loyola in Chicago. It's one of the largest hospitals. There's a VA component to it. He wasn't sure if it was the largest, but it's one of the largest. He runs an ICU. He's one of the few practicing individuals that's a pulmonologist that actively runs an ICU. He's written the book on mechanical ventilation, 1,500 pages. The prosecution showed the book. He's also written approximately 750 academic papers, which is an absolutely wild-ass number. He goes into a little detail about his history and what he looks into. He talks about how breathing, which is what his focus is math and physics. So here you have a doctor who's about to go down the math and physics path. And it's amazing testimony.
To be quite honest with you, the fact that he's able to distill down everything, every mechanical thing that happens in the lungs to math and science, he basically dispels every single thing that the defense is trying to say happened to George Floyd. To the point where we get into the physics of what is it like to breathe. There's a slide of him discussing everything. So, he talks about what is asphyxia, what happens when you're in sitting down, what happens when you're prone. He goes over important lung mechanics, right? Basically lying somebody on their stomach, on their chest, decreases your actual volume of your lungs by 24%. And then you start adding in things like he's handcuffed, he's on cement, and you're decreasing the volume he can take in. So he basically goes over continuously all the mechanical parts of what's going on with George Floyd, to the point where he's doing things like he's calculating he's at 22 breaths a minute, right? And if we see somebody that's high on an opioid like fentanyl, we should see a 40% reduction in his amount of breathing attempts, and we're not seeing that. So he's not high on fentanyl. He can't be, because fentanyl suppresses the breathing. He can say things like, I know what his lung volume is, because most human beings on average have this lung volume. And it gets into every single detail of everything, from how slow he's breathing to his gasping breaths to, you know, how long he's down for, the angle of the neck, the pressure on the neck. I mean, I don't want to jump the gun here, but there is so much to talk about on this guy that we could probably spend an entire episode just in his testimony.
The key takeaways are that he fixates on the time period of 5 minutes and 3 seconds out of the 9 minutes and 29 seconds, because he determines that after 5 minutes and 3 seconds, the patient has brain damage and is effectively dead. He's completely disinterested in the 4 minutes and whatever, 20 seconds and change, because based on his analysis of the video, George Floyd has brain damage and is no longer breathing at that time. The prosecution, along with his testimony, also presented a 3D model reconstruction of the various officers, and they can take away the car, so you can see it from kind of like a 3D angle. It was a really cool graphic. And he did a calculation that said for 90% of the video, his left knee was on George Floyd's neck.
That's a huge statistic. He actually went through and he calculated time that 90% of the time it was on his neck. It's not, oh, I accidentally moved it off my back. It's not that, oh, I was adjusting my weight or I was just trying to subdue him. 90% of that 5 minutes, he had his knee on his neck.
And as part of this knee on the neck thing, he did pressure calculations and he did airflow restriction calculations, and he had a slide where it showed as airflow restriction increases, what is your oxygen intake, and he talked about how it was a squared concept, so it's exponential. So as airway restriction increases, once you get to about 85% restriction, you start to have breathing issues. So he calculated all of this based on Chauvin's weight and the weight of the equipment and the video and whether his foot was off the ground or not. He had a slide where his foot was off the ground.
That's really important too, because when you talk about the weight distribution, he goes in and basically says that, you know, there's these academic studies. These academic studies say that, you know, if I put this so much weight on your back, here's how much additional breathing requirement it is for you, or weight on your back from here. But essentially, the study is that they have someone laying prone and they stick 2 45-pound weights on the guy's back. On the back, not the neck.
And they're on a mat too, not concrete.
And he goes through and says, here's some more assumptions. And essentially, the knee on the neck is like, what, 10 times more force applied to his neck than those weights were on that person's back.
Yep.
Which is incredible to say, because now you're saying I have 90 pounds spread out over a square foot or whatever it is, down to his knee, which is like 12 square inches or something. I mean, it's really amazing testimony at this point in time.
And he goes through and basically just says that this study is bullshit.
Yeah, because the force, it's unethical, one. And two, you can't really get anything out of it, because it's not really truly what's happening in the study. He's going through, he's basically saying all these previous studies are bullshit, this is what's really happening. And he's also doing it for free, because he basically admits he's never done a criminal case before. He does basically all civil procedures, lawsuits, malpractice lawsuits. You know, where somebody doesn't intubate right, or someone puts the pressure wrong, or someone doesn't do something for pulmonology correctly, whatever happens to be asthma medicine, whatever it is. He does that kind of shit. Here he's doing, for free, basically all the analysis it takes to put Chauvin behind bars. He dispels the notion that if you can talk, you can breathe.
Yep.
So essentially George Floyd is shallow breathing the entire time. And your lungs are made in such a way that you don't actually breathe in and out all the air in your lungs. You don't get rid of all the gas. There's gas that's still trapped in your lungs. And you have, I won't go into the science because it's part of the slide deck and it's really sweet, but you basically have the working amount of that goes in and out. That's your breath, and it's a small amount relative to the total volume. Then you have like this two different reserve systems. One, which is your extra oxygen that you have, just sort of sitting there. One is basically like if you collapse out your lungs, all the air that's left over in the alveoli, which is the small little sacs in your lungs, or like, I guess, grape clusters, I guess he called them at one point in time, in your lungs that hold all this extra air. So you have these little sacs of air. You have the bigger trunk and the big parts of your lungs. Then you have essentially just the lungs that the part of the lungs that expand and contract. This is very similar. It's hard to see without a diagram of, like, let's say a water bottle. It's full of air. You're just kind of squeezing a little bit in and out. That's basically your breath. You're just exchanging a tiny amount of air, like some percentage, 10, 20% of the air out. The rest of that volume that's in there is just air that's sitting in your lungs that allows you to have reserve oxygen. And when what happens, especially what happened to George Floyd here, is that when you're taking shallow breaths, you're slowly depleting your reserve oxygen. So it's like you slowly crushing the bottle of air that you have, or your bottle of water, right? Slowly crushing it and removing as much as you can. And eventually you run out of bottle you can crush. Eventually you run out of reserve oxygen. And then you're left with just that little bit that's left that you can't crush out of the bottle. And that is your final reserve. And that's what's in the alveoli, or ravioli, whatever it's called. And when that depletes, that's basically now when you no longer have oxygen that you can exchange out. And that's what happened to George Floyd. And that's basically when he became brain dead.
And the witness put together a set of slides that had stills of basically video where it's like, okay, George Floyd is struggling. He's using his knuckles to try and brace against the tire so that he can slightly move his right side of his body so that he can get air. And now his hand's on the ground and he's trying to brace so that he can get slightly more air. And now he's literally putting his face into the pavement so that his neck can be solid so that his windpipe is open so that he can breathe.
That's when his forehead's down, right?
Yep.
Against the concrete.
And then there's a segment where he goes...
Is that the flicking you were
referring to? You can see his eyes. He's conscious. And then you see that he isn't. That's the moment the life goes out of his body.
And it's a video, and it literally plays, and you, like, you functionally see George Floyd die. And it's like, yep, this happened. Prosecution asks a couple more questions. I think the key additional piece of testimony is that Dr. Tobin testified that a healthy person subjected to what Mr. Floyd was subjected to would have died.
Which is important because the defense is spending all their time saying that George has a bad heart, he's a drug addict, he's a history of all the stuff. So there's a reason why this is an important statement.
Yep. There's some more discussion about breathing and how long it takes to actually lose consciousness if you don't have oxygen. It's incredibly medical and incredibly worth watching. And pretty much everybody that does anything in the law enforcement context should watch this. The cross is generally pretty vacuous. The attempted statement was to basically say, well, your models are approximations and physics doesn't work like that. And the guy was basically like, no, this is all calculable. It's all empirical data. Yeah, I'm making assumptions about what Chauvin weighs, but, like, who gives a shit? Is it 140 pounds? Is it 138 pounds? Is it 140? Like, it doesn't functionally matter.
They're trying to basically dispel science. Science is bullshit. This guy's a liar. And it didn't go very well for the defense here because they weren't up against a standard witness. They were up against somebody who knew what they were talking about. And he didn't have to go and say things like, oh, let me get back to you, or I had to check, and things like that. No, he could rattle off the equations probably in his sleep because he's taught them 1,000 times. He just knows what he's talking about all day long. It's just incredible.
This is the expert witness of all expert witnesses. This guy is as on top of his field as any other person in existence in any other field.
Can fentanyl cause death? Yes.
Yes.
When dying from fentanyl, does coma occur? Yes. Was George Floyd in a coma? No.
So the general takeaway from this witness is that it is his medical opinion that George Floyd died of low oxygen caused by the knee to the neck. This would have happened to anybody, not just George Floyd. His underlying medical conditions, which were discussed, were not a cause of his death. It was the knee to the neck. It was not a fentanyl overdose. It was not a meth overdose. And we know this because this. So this witness is saying everything to support the prosecution because he firmly believes it with all of his expertise. He's not just there for a paycheck because he's literally not getting paid.
Really watch this video. It's just search day 8 and start at hour 2. I think NBC has a good coverage of it.
The next witness is a forensic toxicologist at NMS Labs, which is the lab that does the toxicology for the Hennepin County Medical Examiner. This witness primarily talked about how many drugs were in George Floyd's system at the time. This is a fairly technical discussion. The general takeaway is that he had 11 nanograms per milliliter of fentanyl and 5.6 nanograms per milliliter of norfentanyl. which is the metabolization of fentanyl. This was something I didn't know. It was interesting. And then he had 1 nanogram per milliliter of meth. This witness described meth as very low. For all intents and purposes, I don't think meth is even relevant to anything here. And a number of future medical people say that it's very low, it's small. So we're kind of just going to gloss over this because it's not that interesting. This witness also added a lot of context in terms of statistics applied to a general population. He works in a lab. He has access to a lot of data. He created a data set of people that were dead and had drugs in their system at certain concentrations. Then he created a set of people that had DUI and had drugs in their system at certain concentrations. And the general takeaway is that George Floyd's numbers more closely resemble those from the DUI group than from the dead group. Even hypothetically, if George Floyd died of a drug overdose, this witness is saying that he didn't have an insane amount of drugs in his system. 11 nanograms per milliliter is not an off-the-charts number where you sit back and go, how is this guy alive? There were people driving that had 11 nanograms per milliliter in their system. So that's a motor skill. You shouldn't be driving with that much fentanyl in your system, but you're not dead is the point of this. There was a fair amount of discussion about what norfentanyl is, and the general takeaway is that it's not knowable whether George Floyd took a lot of fentanyl and he was metabolizing it quickly at 5.6 nanograms per milliliter, or if he just had a residual amount of norfentanyl from a previous dosage. That's an open question that's really never answered throughout anybody's testimony. The cross basically tried to say, what are the thresholds? What are the accuracy? How do we know these are accurate?
Yep. Again, dispelling science.
What's the measurement accuracy? How do we know these are real?
Yeah, and at some point, it is a true question, right? Because if you're being prosecuted on, 0.3 nanograms of methamphetamine in your blood system as proof you're high on methamphetamines, yes, I can understand why you might want to ask the resolution and, accuracy of these tests and what are the fundamental limits and how are the samples prepared. And you may want to question how the hell you're going to, prosecute somebody on such low dosage. Some of my questions would be, well, how did you handle this? What's the metabolic rates? I would have asked some questions that were tougher that would have stumped them.
Yeah, they should be able to calculate the metabolic rate from some consideration of factors, like how big was this individual?
Mm-hmm.
What was his prior drug use? Is norfentanyl, metabolized at 5.6 nanograms per milliliter? Like, how much time are we talking there? The witness did raise this ratio of fentanyl to norfentanyl of 1.96 and did some comparisons to previous data, but I don't know that it means anything because you can't answer the question of how long has the norfentanyl been there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just don't know. And this witness did nothing to elaborate on, well, 5.6 nanograms of milliliter is pretty common because the average human digests fentanyl or metabolizes fentanyl at a rate of blah, 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 blah. Like, it's a chemical reaction. Like, what is it? Let's try to quantify it, but there's no attempt there. The recross of the defense tried to get at, like, some weird sampling error questions and was like, well, if we're looking at the deceased group of stats, how do we know that they didn't all die of car accidents and the numbers don't mean anything? And the witness was basically like, well, I mean, given that this is a hypothetical and I know that this subset does not contain all car accidents, this is false. And the defense kind of tried to argue with him. And the witness was like, that's not really a possibility. And then Nelson ran away.
Well, normally when you're trying to do science, you have control groups or at least groups that you understand the context of the group. You don't just randomly grab 48 dead bodies out of the morgue and start doing shit to them. Normally, there's history, and you try to classify and cluster them.
And he took 2 big buckets, basically. You could probably filter it down and maybe look at cause of death, but he created 2 buckets, and I think the 2 buckets were favorable to the prosecution. And the defense didn't do any legwork to try and create smaller buckets that were favorable to their point of view.
Yeah, like how many people were black, age 30 to 50? Right?
Yep. What's the weight?
Had a drug usage requirement, right? Had COVID. Well, none of them had COVID. Well, guess what? None of your data is reliable. It's no different than the manager of the Challenger. Is it the Challenger that exploded from the manager?
Yeah. Yeah.
Going, oh, the O-ring data. Did you make a test at 40 degrees? No. Well, then we can't use your data. I'm extrapolating. What do you mean?
We've never launched a rocket this cold, but we're extrapolating, yeah. So it's fine.
We're extrapolating.
Yeah. I don't care how cold it is, that rocket's going up. So the next witness was a police surgeon for the Louisville Police Department. And this guy also had a background in forensic medicine and emergency medicine. He was a doctor, but now he works for the police. He had a massive comb over. It was actually kind of marginally impressive.
Yeah, this is the person that is the surgeon for police, right?
Yeah, which I didn't even know was a position, but he's basically the doctor, like the lead doctor of Louisville Police Department. And he provides actual medical training, which seems like a good position. Seems like a role that should exist.
The institution of police is still about policing the worker. But this may be one sliver of an individual whose job it is to divert some of their energy from shooting unarmed poor people to attempting to give them some medical training so that they have at least some recognition of when medical needs to be done.
Yeah, it seems like a generally noble objective. Now, the reason for his testimony and the reason why he was called is because that he believes in excited delirium. So we're not going to go around patting him on the back too hard. But the general theory seems to be, what better way to dispel excited delirium than to call somebody that believes in excited delirium and does not believe it applied to the situation? So it's a strategy by the prosecution. So this witness presented a list of the 10 signs of excited delirium.
Oh boy, this is good. This is good.
And stated that a minimum of 6 are required for a diagnosis. So we're going to go through the 10.
A couple of these are insane that they don't actually even count, I don't think. I want you to guess which ones I'm talking about here. I'm going to go through them. Here we go. The 10 signs of excited delirium. This feels like one of those like David Letterman jokes?
Yeah.
The top 10 list, the whatever
top
it is?
10, yeah. The top 10 signs that you have created a construct that exists to remove culpability from police killing a black individual.
I'll go backwards.
Yeah, number 10.
Yeah. Excessive sweating. Oh, do you know the way that sweats? I know some of that sweats. I hate David Letterman. He's not funny. Okay, so with excessive sweating, that's number 10. Number 9, excessive heat, hot to touch.
I don't know how 9 and 10 are different, but okay.
I guess one is, the crazy part is with excessive sweating, from a pure physics point of view, you're attempting to cool the skin. So number 10 is you're sweating a ton. Number 9 is you're not sweating, or you just ran a fucking marathon. One of those two things, because you could have a fever and be excessive hot to the touch. Or you could be attempting to, like, cool your body down and be hot as shit. So 9, it doesn't matter. Excessive heat, hot to touch, it's wild. Number 8, very rapid breathing.
George Floyd wasn't breathing, right?
He wasn't breathing, so that knocks it out. 7, this is the trope. This is the stereotype here, ready? Unaffected by pain.
The crack gives you superpowers. And the witness was going through and dispelling each one of these along the way. Kind of like we're doing, but non-sarcastically.
Yeah, number 6, though, here, you just said it. Unexpected, unusual strength. Number 5, here we go. Not tiring despite heavy exertion. Number 4, constant, near constant physical activity. Number 3, failure to respond to police presence. Number 2, attraction to glass. Destruction of glass, mirrors, lights on vehicles. I don't even know what the hell this is. And number 1, this is probably the most important one here. Inappropriate clothing. Naked, partially clothed. Okay, so a couple of these are insane. Attraction to glass. I don't know. I guess the attraction to glass.
What the fuck is that? Like, we sliced and diced a data set and found that all the black people that we killed in custody liked glass or tried to punch through a window or some shit, so it must be attracted to glass.
Here's a scenario I have, right? Inappropriate clothing because I'm hot, so take my shirt off. I was just running, right? I was just running away from the police that were trying to shoot me, right? I'm excessively hot and sweating, rapidly breathing. And I'm trying to run so my adrenaline's pumping because I'm scared for my fucking life. So I'm unaffected by pain because that's what happens with adrenaline, right? And you have unexpected, unusual strength. And you're not tiring from despite exertion because you're trying to get the fuck away from being murdered by the cops.
You're trying to not fucking die.
Die, yeah. And constant, near constant physical activity. Yeah, again, you're trying to not die from the cops. Failure to respond to the police. You're trying, again, not to die from the cops. In fact, you may even break a window because you're trying to not die from the cops. All 10 of these sound like the cops are basically trying to murder you and you're trying to get away. Because all 10 of these, besides like getting naked, are something you would expect if like a monster was chasing you. Literally. Think about it that way. If zombies are coming after you, if you're The Walking Dead, that stupid fucking show that's not even good. If you're trying to get away from these zombies that are going to kill you, real life example, This is a literal example. You're a zombie hunter. You've lost your crossbow. You're no longer, your bunker is being overrun by the zombies. You bought Zombie Hunter magazine. You're trying to get away. You'd have all 10 of these, besides, again, maybe taking off your pants because you want to run faster.
The cargo pockets get in the way.
Well, they keep swaying because you got all your heavy like shit in there, so like it's throwing your rhythm down.
Chafing.
And that's why you got to get that speed stick on the thighs. Imagine living that life. God damn, it'd be fucked up.
So this witness goes through and dispels all 10 signs of excited delirium and concludes that excited delirium did not matter in this context.
Why is that important?
This is important because the defense wants it to be excited delirium because excited delirium as it exists as a mechanism to absolve officers of using excessive force. Oh, he had superhuman powers. I had no choice but to kill him. I was fearful of my life.
It's the same idea that you just said it. Fearful of your life is a construct you cannot prove or disprove. You cannot prove or disprove that someone was fearing for their life because you could say things like, I thought he had a knife. I was scared. How the fuck are you scared? You have a bulletproof vest on that's a stab-proof vest. You're trained in martial arts. You have a fucking taser, a handgun, and pepper spray. Like, what the fuck? What are you scared of? That he might slash at you and you're going to have to tase him? Like, what the hell? He's going to throw it at you and you're not going to be able to catch it like a fucking ninja?
So the rest of the testimony is pretty medically based. It's nothing new from the previous medical testimony. He believes that the restraint was excessive. There was discussion about the autopsy. This witness did get paid. He also believes that low oxygen was the cause of death, just like Tobin. It's the defense trying to throw the trope of George Floyd as an unhealthy black man, and that's why he died. And this witness is like, nah. So you get a literal cop. You get a cop that believes in excited delirium, who's also a doctor, who doesn't think excited delirium mattered, and believes that the excessive use of force led to George Floyd's death, and not the underlying medical condition, because he's a doctor and knows. So I think this was a really good witness for the prosecution to further kind of delineate that this was a homicide.
Yeah, you know, they checked off the idea that you can't die from drugs. They checked off that the prosecution checked off that this is, he did not have excited delirium. He wasn't some strong, crazy person. They checked it off that he didn't die of COVID. They checked off that he didn't die from anything but murder, knee to the neck.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.